puzzled me about Hegel. You see, Hegel died in 1831, but I think his last essay is an essay on the English Reform Bill of 1832. So I'm wondering, how was he able to write on the Reform Bill of 1832 if he died in 1831? It's an interesting question, don't you think? Actually, the answer is he was writing, the bill was under discussion before it was passed in 1832, so that's how he was able to write on it. He didn't have precognition. And you know also the one other Hegel joke. Did I give you the one about the professor who lectured his class about Hegel, Schlegel, and Bagel? You see, after he completed that lecture, he told the class to forget what he'd said about Bagel because there's no such person. Yes, now, before I get into the main subjects of the lecture today, I just want to cover a couple points that came up the last time. And remember, the last time I gave an objection to an argument that Karl Popper and others, I quoted Tom Palmer, said that we can't know our future knowledge because if we knew it now, it wouldn't be future knowledge. And you remember I objected to that. I said, well, this is just defining a certain way of defining future knowledge as knowledge we don't know now. So naturally, anything we know now we won't be future knowledge in that sense. But that doesn't limit our powers of prediction at all, because it's just saying we're not going to call anything we predict future knowledge, but we could have future knowledge in the sense of things we predict now and will continue now. So some people wrote to me and they felt that they are very sympathetic to the philosophical view that we don't in fact know the future, know much about the future. So one thing I want to make clear, and this is, I think, the reason I'm mentioning this is one of the most important points I'm trying to hope get you to understand, hope you'll understand in this class, is that in logic, what we're teaching, we're just concerned with the structure of a particular arguments rather than a conclusion. So when I present an objection to this particular argument, that isn't at all a way of establishing that we can know the future, that we're able to predict our future, our knowledge. It's not at all a comment on what our powers of predictability is. We're just concerned with how, whether this particular argument works. So I just want to make clear, you know, if you hold philosophical views that you think we have very limited knowledge of the future, we don't know the future at all, that's perfectly all right with me, at least for this class. All I'm concerned with is the structure of a particular argument. Now, the next thing I want to mention, again, this is preliminary to the going over the lecture, the material for today's lecture. You remember one of the lectures, I think it was lecture number 3, I mentioned an argument by Anthony DeJasse, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, and what that argument was, you recall, he said he had an argument in favor of the property ownership by the first claimer. And he said, well, there's an easy way to show the first claimer acquires property. Because he said, well, suppose the first person to claim certain land, he said, well, what grounds could somebody object to this? It would only be that the person already owned the property. I own the Mises Institute, and then Lou Rocco could say, no, you don't own the Mises Institute, I have a prior claim, or whoever it is who does own the museums that have prior claim. So if I'm the first one though to claim something, nobody else could make an ownership claim, so then my claim would be valid. And you remember, I objected to that. I said, well, he's begging the question by assuming that all claims are ownership claims. And what if you had other claims beyond ownership claims? Now, I'm mentioning it because there's an additional objection fallacy that DeJassy's argument illustrates. I mean, supposing we try to repair the argument, and some people suggested this to me in emails. I had one email saying, well, what if you just take the argument to be, say, take any claim at all to property as an ownership claim, or just reformulate the argument and say, if the only person who could object to my claiming the property is someone who had any kind of claim at all to the property, but if no one has such a claim, then my claim would stand. Now, does anyone see where there's a problem there? Does anyone see what the problem is? You see, we might think, well, we have a pretty good argument. We don't have to worry about homesteading. There's no way to verify, Eric says, no, what hypothetical tautology. These are interesting suggestions, but it's not quite what I, the one I have. That's not to say you're wrong, but it's just not the way I'm thinking of. Remember, supposing the argument is right, you'd be saying no one could object to the first claim on the grounds of a prior claim, because by hypothesis, this is the first claim. So supposing that's right, what does that show? That would show nobody could object because of another claim. You can't object because of a prior claim, since this is the first claim. But what DeJassy is concluding from that is you can't object. So all the argument shows, if it's right, is that you can't object because of another claim to the property. But that doesn't show you don't have any grounds for objection at all. I mean, one way you could object is simply to say to the claimant, well, all right, you're the first one to claim it, but why should we accept your claim? I mean, supposing I say, I now own the moon. It turns out I'm the first one to claim it. So I'm not interfering with any of your claims to the moon if you don't have any, but it doesn't follow you have to accept my claim. You could just say, why do we have to accept that? So what this fallacy is taking a relative assertion, namely that there's no objections because of some prior claim, and making it into an absolute assertion, there are no objections, and that's what the fallacy is there. Now, okay, with that out of the way, we can now go into the main subject for today's lecture, and what Joyce is trying to do in this very short chapter on Categorical Syllogism in Part 2, is he's trying to give what is the deeper foundation for the syllogism. You know, remember, we've explained a syllogism works. We have the subject and predicate in the conclusion, and then in the major premise, you have the predicate is linked to what's called the middle term. Minor premise, the subject is linked to the same term, the middle term. So this middle term enables you to connect the subject and predicate, and you can come up with something new. So what Joyce is asking is, well, is there kind of, what is the deeper explanation? How does this work? Well, I just noticed Jeremy had the right answer, at least what I thought was the right answer to the JASA problem, so good for him. Now, the answer Joyce gives to this this question, what is the ultimate foundation of the syllogism, is what's called the dictum de omnia nullo. This is the Latin phrase. Dictum in Latin means a maxim or a saying, and omni is all and nullo is none. They're in this form because they're the objects of the preposition de. So that's why they're spelled in that way. So what this dictum de omni is saying is that whatever is affirmed or denied universally of any subject is thereby affirmed or denied every logical part of the subject. And what that means is, supposing that we say, let's take the example, all men are mortal, we're saying that it's a necessary property of men that they're mortal. This is one of their the property of the concept. This concept of man has as one of its constituents the property of being mortal. So if that's the case, any particular man is also mortal. Let's see, what's affirmed in this case would be the maxim dictum de omni. What's affirmed of the subject is affirmed universally, is affirmed of every part of the subject. And we could have one say, if you said no man is immortal, that would be denied. The concept of man would exclude immortality. So then this dictum, this would be dictum de nullo, would be saying no particular man is immortal. And the scholastics thought this was the fundamental principle of reasoning. They thought this was really getting at the essence of what involved in reasoning. And I give another example, it's a feeble attempt at humor here. I say, all men are elephants, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is an elephant. So here I'm saying, of course, falsely, that one of the necessary characteristics of being a man is being an elephant. So Socrates, like a part of this of man, he's one of the men, so then he's an elephant. So it's what's affirmed universally of men is affirmed of a part of a class of men, that is, i.e. Socrates. Now, how do we know that this dictum is true? How do we know that what's affirmed or denied of the class universe is affirmed of any logical part of the class? The basic way we know this is that we directly grasp its truth. That there, in the scholastic view, which I think is correct view, there are some propositions, some judgments that we make, we can just grasp right away that they're true. Like, so we say, well, how do we know that 2 plus 2 equals 4? Well, we just see right away that it's true. How do we know law of contradiction is true? We just grasp it right away. I should say there are some philosophers who don't like this notion of things we just grasp. For example, Karl Popper and his many followers get really upset if anybody claims their self-evident truth. They want to say everything is a hypothesis. You just really make guesses about things and then try to refute them if we can. Of course, that's a hypothesis too. That isn't, they're not contradicting themselves if they say that. They don't like the idea of self-evident truth. Even if they, whether they like it or not, they think it's not the case. But this scholastic view, which I think is very plausible, when we do grasp this, we see right away while something is applying to the whole concept, anything that falls under that concept is also going to apply to that as well. Now, there's another action. Remember, one of the basic laws of thought, because you would both affirm an A proposition and an O proposition about the same subject, saying, my example, you'd be saying, all men are elephants, but some man is not an elephant. So this would be a direct contradiction. So if you didn't get it from the just grasping this dictum as self-evident, then this is another way you can understand why it's true. It's violating the law of contradiction. One thing very important that I went over a little bit already is that when we talk about the universal subject, we're taking the subject as a whole rather than a collection of individuals. So when we say all men are mortal, we're asking what's true of the concept men, or concept man. Is, if this proposition all men are mortal is true, then mortality is a necessary characteristic of men. It isn't that we're just considering each man separately and saying, oh, this one is mortal, this one is mortal, this one is mortal, so then all men are mortal. But it's not the result of an enumeration. And in fact, I suppose we try to reason by enumeration. Suppose we argue as examples, so we say all students in this course are interested in logic. So we say, well, Andreas is a student in this course, therefore Andreas is interested in logic. Now, is this an example of good argument? Oh, I should say, Michael asked a question that when I was talking about the Popper, that they don't contradict themselves that way. The reason they don't is that when they say everything is a hypothesis, they're not claiming that something we see is self-evident. They're saying that's a hypothesis too. So that's why it isn't a contradiction. So getting back to the example I was just giving, is this good reasoning? When I say all students in this course are interested in logic, Andreas is a student in this course, therefore Andreas is interested in logic. Is this is this a good reasoning? What do people think about that? Well, we have two different answers. We have yes and obviously impossible. Seems we could be good in some cases. The way Joyce is taking it, you see, we could ask, how, suppose we have this premise, all students in this course are interested in logic. Yes, Anish, I think, is on exactly right lines. How could we know that's true? How would we find out all students in the course are interested in logic? Well, the only plausible way would be just to find out for each student is that he or she interested in logic. We could go through every student and ask, are you interested in logic? And suppose everybody answered yes. So then we know all students in this course are interested in logic. But if we did that, we would already know that Andreas is interested in logic, because he would be one of those we would have asked, so we know he's interested in logic. So the syllogism wouldn't be establishing anything new, we'd already know it. And remember, syllogism is supposed to give us something, a new proposition, one we didn't know before. So Joyce doesn't count enumeration as really reasoning. Now, let me just get a few, I see some interesting questions. Eric once said, well, we could never know the standard syllogism this way. That's what we get into that later. That was exactly John Stuart Mill's objection to the syllogism. We'll be getting to that later in the lecture. Now, just one thing, if I can go back a little bit. Michael says, you know, on the Popperian claim where they're saying there are no self-evident truths, just hypotheses. That's just a hypothesis. So he says it's not a very strong claim. Well, the Popperians wouldn't say that. They'd say, you know, hypothesis can survive attempts to refute it. So they probably would say that's consistent with saying it is a strong claim. They think it's a good hypothesis. So you don't have to always be, in Germany, to respond to Germany, you don't have to always begin your, have a self-evident truth in your syllogism. I mean, some truths are, I mean, you can have syllogisms that aren't self-evident, the ones you believe to be true for various reasons, but you don't have to think they're self-evident. So let's say, in reason by enumeration, Joyce wouldn't count that as a real example of reasoning, because reasoning, you're coming up with something new. So what you're in fact doing, genuine reasoning, you're asking, you're dealing with a matter of conceptual necessity. You're saying, what are the necessary properties of a particular concept? And then you're saying, this one part falls under that, or is excluded, or properties are such that nothing well, in this class will have a certain property, and then you say particular doesn't have that property, so that would be reasoning de novo. Okay, now, one the fallacy of division, what we do is we have a conjunction, per se, and then we apply what is true of the whole conjunction is wrongly taken to apply to the parts of conjunction. Like, suppose I say something like anyone who has the ability and is willing to practice will get a spot on the NFL football team. And then somebody said, well, I'm willing to practice, so it follows that from what you're saying, if you're right, that I'm going to get a spot on the NFL football team. Well, that isn't right, because the premise is a conjunction, that anyone who has the necessary ability and is willing to practice will get a spot on the team. So you can't just say because this is true of someone who fulfills this whole conjunction, it's also true if someone just fulfills one part of it. So in here we're dealing, let's say, with a conjunction, not as in the dictum de omni. We're not talking about what's implied by a concept. We're here talking about a conjunction. And what's trickier is the conjunction can be implicit. Probably very few, if any, people would make the claim, the argument I gave, you know, with this football player. It's pretty easy to see what's wrong with that, but it's harder if the conjunction is implicit. And I want to give you a famous example that commits this, where you can see this fallacy of division actually in operation. Now, this is probably, those of you who've taken courses or read on Austrian economics, they're probably familiar with the famous diamond water paradox. Now, before the Marginalist Revolution, Karl Menger and others in the 1870s, most economists thought that subjective values couldn't explain prices. You know, if you think what explains price, well, you say supply and demand, and then you say what explains supply and demand, so the natural way of thinking would probably be to say, well, that just depends on people's valuations of things, how people things have a higher low demand depending on how people rank those things in their scale of preferences. And this is one a lot of people before the 19th century had that idea. Spanish scholastics and others had this idea, but some of the 19th century economists, late 18th century economists like Adam Smith and David Ricardo, thought there was a big objection to this. And their argument went this way. They said, water is more valuable than diamonds. And supposing we had, we need water to survive, but diamonds are just a luxury. So suppose we had a choice of getting rid of all the diamonds in the world or getting rid of all the drinking water. Well, we'd naturally get rid of the diamonds. We couldn't live at all without water. So then they said, well, if subjective value explains prices, then water will have a higher price than diamonds. You see how he says subjective value is supposed to explain prices. Water is valued more highly than diamonds, so the price of water should be higher than the price of diamonds. But in fact, that isn't true. Diamonds have a higher price than water. So before we get into what's wrong with the what the fallacy is showing this fallacy of division, we'll see, let's just look at the structure of the paradox. So remember, in logic, the basic idea is in this syllogism, if we're reasoning from premises to a conclusion, we have two premises and a conclusion. So we say, if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true. So what we've done here, so we have a valid argument, let's say one that's correctly reasoned, that water has a higher price than diamonds. But the conclusion is false. Diamonds have a higher price than water. So what happens then? Suppose we say, if the premises are true, then the conclusion is true, but the conclusion is false. So what happens then? Well, then we know at least one of the premises must be false, because if both premises were true, then the conclusion would be true, but the conclusion isn't true. So you see, the only way to avoid getting outright contradiction, say one of the premises is false. Now, this type of reasoning, it's similar, you've probably heard of reductio ad absurdum arguments. This reasoning here is similar to that, but it's not the same. In a reductio ad absurdum argument, we show that a particular hypothesis, a particular assumption, leads to a contradiction, so it's false. We say something like, we're assuming this, therefore this leads to contradiction, it's false. I could give you examples, like Bertrand Russell once said, common sense leads to science. Well, no, let's cancel that one. That isn't really a reductio, it's just direct contradiction, so forget that one. My head isn't working today, as you no doubt have noted. But so getting back to this diamond water paradox, it's not a reductio argument because we're saying the conclusion water has a higher price than diamonds is false, since diamonds in fact have a higher price than water, but it isn't a contradiction. It wouldn't be a contradiction if water had a higher price than diamonds. It's just not true. So what's wrong with the paradox, and this is the reason that I brought it in, because it illustrates this fallacy of division. Water is more valuable than diamonds, true only for the total quantity of water in diamonds. Actually, it could be, say, if we took all the drinking water in the world and said, what is the value of that compared to all the diamonds in the world, then we'd say water is more valuable. And we could have other things, I shouldn't have said only for the total quantity, we could have other quantities where that is true. So if this is right, there's really an implicit conjunction, the premise, water is more valuable than diamonds. It's really saying, well, this amount of water plus this amount of water plus this amount of water is compared with these diamonds plus these diamonds plus these diamonds. If you take it this way, you'll find that all the waters are more valuable than all the diamonds. But it doesn't follow from this that any particular quantity of water will be more valuable than any particular quantity of diamonds. So now I haven't, if you take economics, you'll understand, you bring in the law of marginal utility, you understand how it is that particular amounts of diamonds can in fact be more valuable than particular quantities of water. But I haven't explain that. It would be consistent with what I say, what I'm saying doesn't presuppose truth in law of marginal utility. All I'm saying here is there's a fallacy in the argument that it doesn't follow from saying that something is true of a whole conjunction, that it is true of every part of the conjunction. Having gone over the fallacy of division, I want to come up with kind of the related fallacy, which is one of the most important ones I think people should understand. It's called the fallacy of composition. Now, remember, in fallacy of division, we're saying what applies only to a conjunction is wrongly thought to apply to the parts of the conjunction. Now, here, it's the sort of the reverse of that. We're saying what applies to a part of a conjunction is wrongly applied to the whole conjunction. So I want to give a famous example of this in history of philosophy. It's John Stuart Mill's proof of the principle of utility that appears to commit this fallacy. Mill, in his famous essay, Utilitarianism, what he's trying to defend here. He's a utilitarian, that's to say, he thinks that what the standard in ethics is maximizing happiness. We should try to achieve the greatest happiness for everyone. Now, he understands that in a rather different way from Bentham, kind of a more complicated way, a more nuanced way from Jeremy Bentham, but he's someone who said, well, what we should try to do is maximize happiness. This is the basic principle of ethics. So then he said, well, how can we prove this? He says it's very well-known passage, no reason can be given why the general happiness is desirable except that each person desires his own happiness. This, however, being a fact, we have not only all the proof which the case admits of, but all which is possible to require that happiness is a good. That each person's happiness is a good to that person, and the general happiness, therefore, is a good to the aggregate of all persons. So what Mill is saying here is something like, how do you prove that general happiness is good? He's saying, well, so your happiness is good to you, my happiness is good to me, this person's happiness is good to him, everybody's happiness is good to that person. So then we add up all the happinesses and say that's good to the sum of people, all the people there are. So here's where the fallacy is. He's saying in the phrase, where he says in the general happiness, therefore, a good to the aggregate of all persons. This doesn't follow from each person's taking his own happiness to be good. I could say my happiness is the good, you'd say your happiness is the good, but it doesn't. You don't have to say at all there's such a thing as a good to the aggregate of all persons. Somebody could hold the view that, well, it's only particular people who have goods. The aggregate of all persons doesn't have a good. Now, I see I'll deal with the questions a little bit in a second. Let me just say, remember, the first thing I said right after the jokes, that we have to make a distinction between saying that a argument works or is wrong and that the conclusion of the argument is false. So I have, if this criticism of Mill's point is right, this is not a refutation of utilitarianism. It's just saying this argument doesn't establish that. Now there's some questions here. Well, first, Anish asked, is a fallacy of division applicable to the real world or conceptual in both? Well, I think it would be really applicable to both, really. Now, Jeremy says, but what if my happiness is punching Krugman in the face? Well, that wouldn't really refute what Mill is saying. That would be sort of what you would get when you're aggregating all the happinesses. You'd have some minuses in there as well. It would affect how you'd sum things up, but that wouldn't show that there's some problem with aggregating happinesses. It's not required that they all be they all be compatible with each other. So I don't think that objection would work. So somebody said aggravated assault, that's pretty good. Okay, so this, as I say, if that's what Mill was saying, this appears not to work. Now, while we're beating up on John Stuart Mill, and you'll be seeing he comes in a bit later on in the lecture also, the same paragraph that I quoted from Mill also said, the only proof capable of being given that an object is visible is that people actually see it. The only proof that a sound is audible is that people hear it. In like manner, I apprehend, the sole evidence it is possible to prove that anything is desirable is that people do actually desire it. So here he's asking, well, suppose somebody objected, people want certain things, say we want to have our preferences satisfied, but why does that show that that's a good thing? I mean, suppose people have those preferences, how do you get to the fact that that's objectively good, that they ought to be satisfied? You just have people have certain preferences. So how does it follow that you can get anything that ought out of that? And his answer is, well, how do you prove that something is visible, people actually see it? how you prove it's audible, people hear it, so it's how you prove it's desirable, people actually desirable. I should just say, Allen had objection to Mill that the basis of individual happiness were mutually exclusive. Well, again, that really wouldn't refute, and that would just show you'd have difficulties in adding up things, but that wouldn't really knock out what he's saying, at least I'm not seeing why it does. Okay, so what's wrong here is, well, what would his argument by analogy show? He's saying if the way you prove something is visible is that people actually see it. The way you prove something's audible is that people actually hear it. So what his argument would be showing is that if something is actually desired, this shows that it's capable of being desired. That would be, I think, a pretty good argument. But what he's actually using the argument is to show is that if something is desired, then it ought to be desired. So this is an example of equivocation on what's meant by desirable. The two senses there, desirable in the sense of something actually desired, and something being capable of being desired, and desirable in the sense of something that ought to be desired. So it's an example of fallacy of equivocation. Now, I should say, in fairness to Mill, there have been all sorts of defenses of him that say he isn't guilty of these fallacies, and that they interpret this passage, say, well, if you read it in context, he's really saying something else. And there's a vast literature on this. It seems to me plausible that he is committing these fallacies, but that isn't the only view of the matter. But it is, it certainly is the case that if what he's saying is the way I've represented it, then these are fallacies. Okay, now I want to give another famous example that illustrates this fallacy of composition. It's not one that commits the fallacy of composition, just one that claims that is trying to give it an example of this fallacy. So this fallacy, this example is paradoxically, suppose a single person tries to save, I don't mean an unmarried person, I mean it's just some one person tries to save, then his savings will increase. So it doesn't follow that if everyone tries to save, total savings will go up. It could be the case that people's attempts to save frustrate each other, so not everybody is able to increase savings, and total savings don't increase. Now, this is a very famous argument used by John Maynard Keynes, who didn't like saving much, especially in depression conditions. The argument was actually goes back to the 18th century. Bernard de Mandeville used it in Fable of the Bees in 1714. So you see what the argument is, it's saying if a single person tries to save, savings will increase, but it doesn't follow if everyone tries to save, total savings will go up. If you argue that way, then you'd be committing a fallacy of composition. But no, once again, this fundamental point I mentioned at the start, it doesn't follow from the fact that total savings will go up that it's false that they will. So you can certainly, you could say, I think this is actually the case, the Keynesians are wrong in what they say about these bad consequences of everybody trying to save. They have a mistaken view of this matter, but it's just this particular argument wouldn't show that total savings would go up, because that would be an example of the fallacy of composition. Okay, now, remember the last time I said a little bit about what's called the figure of the syllogism. And remember, the figure of the syllogism refers to the placement of the subject and predicate in each premise. You know, I said this is kind of a complicated matter. We're not going to go into that in any detail. But in the first figure, the major premise has the middle term as the subject of the premise, and in the minor premise, the middle term is the predicate. So I give this example here. No Misesians or Keynesians. All faculty at the Mises Institute are Misesians. Therefore, no faculty at the Mises Institute are Keynesian. So what's the middle term here is the one that doesn't appear in the conclusion is Misesians. And so we see here it's in the first figure because Misesian is the subject of the major premise and the predicate of the minor premise. See, no Misesians, that's the subject, major premise, and the predicate of the minor premise. And this is a valid mood. It has the form EAE, the first figure, and it's illustrating this dictum de nullo, but it says the first premise is excluding Misesians from the class of Keynesian. Then the second premise says all the faculty of the Mises Institute are included in the class of Misesians, so you know that, therefore, no faculty of the Mises Institute are Keynesian, because faculty at the Mises Institute are part of a larger class that's excluded from the class of Keynesian. You wouldn't know from this argument that the class is larger. I should have said the class of the same size or larger, because doesn't really from the premises, you don't know that there are Misesians who are not faculty of the Mises Institute, even though, of course, in reality, we know there are. So the scholastics thought they liked this first figure. They thought that really showed, you can see the dictum in operation most clearly here. Now, remember the first, in what I didn't go into this in detail, but remember there are other figures, there are four figures, and the other figures place the middle term differently from the first figure. But we can get to always, even if we have syllogisms in the second, third, and fourth figures, we can always change around things and get them into the first figure. This is called reducing them. So the reason I mentioned kind of a roundabout way of getting onto one I want to talk about a little bit now is what's called immediate inference. And what in trying to reduce syllogism in these other figures to the first figure, we have to, when we're changing around these premises in the proposition, we have to use various types of immediate inference. So what immediate inference is that without introducing a new term, we can derive a new proposition from a given proposition. So remember, in a syllogism, we take a proposition, we have a middle term that enables us to come up with a new proposition. Here, we don't have a middle term, we just have two terms in the proposition, and we can change the proposition around and come up with something new. Let's see an example of how we do that. Well, one type of immediate inference is called conversion. So here, conversion doesn't refer to changing your religion, but what we're doing here is we're interchanging the subject and predicate. Remember, one theme I've given, I think in probably every lecture, is scholastic logic is a two-term, two-name theory. Every proposition has a subject and predicate, which are both really, they're both taken to be names. So what we're doing in conversion, we're interchanging the name, so what was used to be the predicate is now the subject, and what used to be the subject is now the predicate. So supposing we have all men are mortal, we change that. We want to have mortal as a subject and men as the predicate. So how do? We get some mortals or men. Now, we, in order to do that properly, we have to follow two rules. One is both propositions have to have the same quality. Both have to be both affirmative or both negative. We say we couldn't have, say we want to convert all men immortal, we couldn't have a proposition that started no men or something, or we couldn't have something with a not in it, because this is a proposition. So we can get an I proposition out of it, but we couldn't get an E or an O in the proposition we converted it to. And the second rule is, if a term isn't distributed in the original proposition, it can't be distributed in the new proposition. So this would explain why couldn't we say all men are mortal. Why can't we change that to all mortals or men? Why can't we convert that to all mortals or men? Well, because when we started off, when we said all men are mortal, we haven't said how much of the class of mortals is covered by men. So so that's why we couldn't convert. Now I see there's a question here. No, Andy asked, no men are mortals would reduce to all men are not mortal. It would reduce to it would reduce to no mortals or men. This I'm just getting to right away. It's a good question. You're anticipating where we're going. So we say, as it's just said, we can't convert all mortals and men because mortals isn't distributed in the original. Now we can convert no Misesians or Keynesians to no Keynesians are Misesians. It should be R rather than two. Should have seen that, but I'm not very good, because an E proposition would say no Misesians or Keynesians. That's saying that Misesians are totally excluded from the class of Keynesians. So it works either way. So this is the answer to Yoshi, is no men are mortals. Why not? Some mortals are not men. Well, you could, that would be true, but you know that no mortals are men, because in the what you're starting with, you're excluding men entirely from the class of mortals. So that's how you know it works either way. Now another type of media inference is called obversion. Now here, remember in conversion we interchange the subject and predicate. Now here what we do, we keep the same subject, but we change the predicate into its contradictory. Instead of saying all men are mortal, we want something with men as the subject, but the predicate would be not mortal instead of mortal. So how do we do that? Well, what we have to do, first we have to change we have to first change the quality of the proposition. We have to convert, you have to change affirmative to negative or negative to affirmative. So when we have all men are mortal, we change it to negative, no men are not mortal. I see how we do that. We just change the quality, and then instead of saying mortal, we have a contradictory, not mortal. Now there are all sorts of other types of immediate inference, obverted, converses, inverses, but we won't go into them here. But one I will go into a little bit because it's kind of interesting is what's called inference by added determination. And here what we do is say we start with a proposition, let's take the old trite one, all men are mortals. Now here we qualify each side in exactly the same way. Say we say all men are mortals, therefore all rational men are all rational mortal. That would be an example where we're adding a determination. We're saying we can add rational to both sides. You have to be very careful when you're doing that. Suppose we say all men are animals, therefore all men with long lifespans are animals with long lifespans. That wouldn't follow because here long lifespan is first taken as long lifespan in relation to men, but it wouldn't follow that long lifespan should also be, might not turn out that way if you took all the various animals. Maybe it wouldn't be such a long lifespan, but your rational, it would work because there you're using it exactly same way. A rational would be used exactly the same way, but having a long lifespan would. Maybe a clear example, suppose you said a mouse is an animal, therefore a big mouse is a big animal. Well, that's false. A big mouse is still a relatively small animal. So you see, if you're doing this, you have to be extremely careful about it. Let's see what's... Now, another thing I want to go into a little bit is getting back, as I said, we're really beating up on John Stuart Mill. He thought, and I think somebody raised this point, I think it was Eric raised this point, he thought syllogism, he didn't like syllogism, he didn't think this was really important in reasoning, because he said any syllogism begs the question. We couldn't know all men are mortal unless we examined each person and found that he was mortal, but then we would already know Socrates was mortal. We wouldn't need the syllogism to prove it. We couldn't learn anything new. Remember, this is the same criticism when I gave this argument by enumeration, where I said all the students in this course are interested in logic. Andreas is student in this course, therefore Andreas is interested in logic. Well, the only way I could find out that all students in the course are interested in logic, I'd already ask them, and then I'd already know Andreas was. So I wouldn't be learning anything. So Mill thought all syllogisms are like that. So that's why he didn't think syllogism was worth anything. So he's taking, as I said, he's taking syllogisms being an argument from enumeration. But on the scholastic view, it isn't an argument from enumeration. We're talking about what necessary feature, the concept of the middle term. We're saying all men are mortal with, say, Socrates a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. We're saying what's a necessary feature, the concept of man is that he's mortal. We're not saying we've gone through all the men that exist or will exist and found out that each one is mortal. Now, one thing I think Joyce doesn't really explain at all. He takes a very negative view, but he doesn't explain, well, why did Mill view syllogisms in this way? And it was because Mill didn't believe in conceptual necessities of the kind the Scholastics had claimed, the basis of syllogism. He didn't think there were any necessary properties of man in the way I'm just trying to explain. So he thought, in fact, that even mathematical truths like 2 plus 2 equals 4, he thought that's just an empirical generalization. We just added up two objects, and the two objects would come up with 4 as the answer. So that's why he thought that. He didn't think, he just didn't recognize necessities of that kind at all. Now let me just try to finish up. I'll just just finish up in a few minutes. Joyce has a distinction we're going to call progressive and regressive syllogism. A lot of syllogism don't fall in either class, but a progressive syllogism is one where we're reasoning from cause to effect. So we say rent control will produce a shortage of apartments. The city council has just imposed rent control, so we will have a shortage of apartments. Now, if you've been very good students, you'll probably notice this hasn't been set up in the canonical form of the syllogism because we don't have a copula is, but you could easily modify this so it'll work out that way. But the basic point here is just that the progressive syllogism is reasoning from a cause to an effect, and regressive syllogism is the other way. We're going from effect to cause, as we say, a business cycle in certain conditions must result from expansion of bank credit. We're now in a business cycle in these conditions, so therefore we conclude business cycles resulted from an expansion of bank credit. Here we're reasoning from effect to cause. And now the last thing, I just want to illustrate, give one example of a fallacy as we discussed this sort of fallacy, I think, before. This is from an economist named Danny Roderick, who's a professor at Harvard. And he said, this dichotomy between markets and state, between trade and rules, is false and hides more than it reveals. Market exchange, and especially long-distance trade, cannot exist without rules imposed from somewhere. So what basically he's saying there is, well, suppose you have an exchange, we have to have certain rules, like we have to know if I say I'm exchanging apples, my apples with your oranges, we have to know who owns the apples and who owns the oranges, and we have to have various rules by which we exchange. So then he's saying, well, then we have to have a state, we have to have the rules imposed from somewhere. So the fallacy here is just where he says imposed from somewhere. It doesn't follow from necessity of rules that these rules have to be imposed, or that we have to have a state. This is a non sequitur. He's just adding something extra, going beyond what he's established. You know, actually, we don't need a state for exchange. It used to be, you know, before the French Revolution, you would have cases where trade took place with nations at war with each other. So you don't have to have kind of a common structure of authority in order to make trade. You know, what about international trade? So he's just adding something extra. Well, I think that will be enough for now. So now for the rest of the time, we can have questions or discussion. Or now I see Michael asked, wouldn't Mill have to examine every assertion to find none are analytic? Well, I mean, again, he could just say that's an empirical generalization too. So I think he would say that. Now Danny asked, what bearing does the problem of universals have on logic? Is scholastic logic compatible with nominalism? Does it presuppose a kind of conceptualism or realism? Now that's a very good question. I'd say there have been scholastics who were nominalists, like William of Ockham, but they would get into a lot of difficulties in trying to explain these necessary properties. So I think you probably would have to presuppose some way, you would have to have some way of saying that there are necessary properties to things beyond in order to conduct the logic in the way the scholastics want. You wouldn't want to get into saying that all we have is truths by enumeration. Now, I see Andreas has a good, has an objection here. He says, I'm wrong in what I said on slide six. Now, Andreas says, well, we could get new information for all students in this class who are interested in logic, because what if you said, you ask all the people in this class if they're interested in logic, then you tell us all students in this class are interested in logic, then I meet someone who's taking this class, couldn't I then conclude the person's interested in logic? I think the mistake is that the assumption you can only know this is true if you counted each person. I don't see why this is true. Well, this is a very interesting point, Andreas. You're certainly right that someone who knew that the argument was sound, let's say knew that the premises, it's certainly true that somebody who knew that the premise was true, they knew all students in the class were interested in logic, that would enable him to know, if he met someone, that person was interested in logic. That's, you're certainly right there, but in the case I gave, is suppose we reason this way. Let's take suppose I say I just meet Eric, so I say, well, is Eric interested in the class, so in logic? So I say, well, yes, he is, because all students in the class are interested in logic. Well, I might find out something if I didn't know that this premise, that if I didn't know that Eric was previously, that Eric was interested in logic, and I might find out that he was, because I accepted this premise, all students in the class are interested in logic. You're perfectly right. But the question is, how could it be known that the premise, all students interested in this class are interested in logic, and that we could know only by asking each one, are you interested in logic? And then it would already, we wouldn't have anything new there, because we would be dependent in establishing the truth of the premise on already establishing that each student is interested in logic. You see, in a genuine reasoning, suppose if it were genuine reasoning, these scholastics take it, I'd be saying there's something that follows from the concept of a student being in this logic class that he's interested in logic, and that doesn't seem plausible. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons somebody could be enrolled in this class, and supposing he'd win some money, somebody's paying him to enroll in this class. You know, he could come up with all sorts of conceivable hypotheses why somebody would be enrolled in this class. It isn't a conceptual necessity. So see, that's what the thing is. Now, let me see. Anish says, two questions on aggregate utility. Given that Mises is a utilitarian, how does aggregate utility relate to the ideas of incommensurability of subjective utility and methodological individualism? Well, Mises doesn't really use aggregate utility. He just said, given what he says, is kind of a very interesting argument, he just says, given the ends that people actually have, and this doesn't involve comparing one person's utility, he said, it will be true for almost everyone that social cooperation through the free market will be something that means that would enable them to achieve their ends. So that's how he reasons. And the second question is, does Mises treat aggregate utility distributively as opposed to collective use implicit in a TADIS justification of utility enhancing interventions? Yes, I don't think he uses the notion of aggregate utility at all, so I think that's either, so that would be, it would, not only does he treat just treat utility of each person, he doesn't really talk about any collective notion of utility. Now, Eric says wants to know if our definition is amendable, does that mean our concepts are amendable? Well, I think we could amend them in the sense we could find out new things about what we're talking about, and we find out what we thought were essential properties weren't really essential, or we kept better ideas of what the essential properties are. And he thinks this is what Popper is getting at. Well, you see, Popper, though, doesn't believe in essences at all. He just takes things as hypotheses, but he doesn't claim that we ever establish essences of things. He thinks definitions are all arbitrary in his view. So I don't think Popper is getting it. Now, so I don't think Popper's getting quite the same thing I was. Now, Andy said, can't you know that all students who are taking the class are interested in logic by assuming that if they weren't interested in logic, they wouldn't be taking the class? Well, I mean, you could assume that, but I mean, I was just taking it as fairly evident that wouldn't be the case. I mean, couldn't you think of other reasons people would take class? What if people take the class just because they want to see what an idiot I am, or they like my jokes? There are all sorts of reasons people could take the class without being interested in logic. Now, Jonathan says, yes, I think that's right. He did have this, his type of utilitarianism is very different from kind of a standard type of use to Bentham and Mill. Leland Yeager has a very good book on defending kind of a similar type of utilitarianism to Mises. You can look that one up. It's a very good book on this. Eric says, very good, interesting point. Popper may not believe it. Ethereal essence, but isn't an essence for the purpose of logic a definition? Not the way Popper's taking it. I mean, a definition to Popper would just be a proposal to use a word in a certain way. So he's not claiming that there are any real necessities in the world. He's just saying that he's choosing to define the book. Although, author, you know, let me just write this out. All right, Sandra likes my jokes. So, well, good for you, Sandra. And how Danny points out has its foundations in morality is a very excellent exposition, sophisticated utilitarian. Yes, that's entirely true. In fact, Yeager thinks very highly of that book and is influenced by it. So I think that is. I recommend that book, Foundation Morality. Everybody should read it if you're interested in ethics. You know, Hazlitt is an extremely good writer. He gives you very good explanations of things. I'd have to go over Bill. I have to go over Hazlitt's book, and I don't think he's taking happiness as a mystical aggregate, though. But I have to go over the book. I think he's just saying, well, we're just trying to take what would make most people happy. I don't think he's assuming there's some sort of collective entity that's happy or unhappy, but I'd have to look through the book. I think I read that book in the mid-1960s, you know, so it's been, you know, I can't say the argument's entirely fresh in my mind. Oh, did I didn't, I forgot to put this. How do I do this? Oh, wait a sec. Yeah, that's the author of the book I was talking about on utilitarians. Now, Dan says, Milton's essays seem to refer to Bentham and Mill's utilitarianism, not Mises and Hamsun. Yes, that's a good point. I may come in because Murray Rothbard used the term kind of when he talked about utilitarianism, he meant it more kind of a standard way. He had criticisms of Mises also, but you know, Murray spoke about utilitarianism, he meant it in this way. And I think one reason also people use utilitarianism in that way is that that's kind of a more standard sense of utilitarianism in philosophy. If you told a philosopher you were utilitarian, he wouldn't expect you to be taking a position rather like Mises. Yes, Floyd points out that Leland is still alive. Yes, he's in his 80s. He's still writing too. Very good economist. Now, Jesse said, what do you think of Mill's kind of collective opinion in On Liberty? Well, what he says there, he doesn't really distinguish adequately between use of force or use of threatened force and the pressure of public opinion. He's very concerned, supposing you have a style of life that most people in your society think very badly of, so there's sort of a lot of pressure on you not to follow that. I mean, let's suppose, well, be an example. I mean, supposing, say, you're very sympathetic to the Taliban and you're living in a small town in the Midwest, probably people would put a lot of pressure on you not to hold those. But so Mill would take, say, people, it's desirable that that kind of pressure not exist, but he doesn't really distinguish, in my view, adequately between saying people should not be subjected to that kind of pressure and people shouldn't be forced to have force used against them. Now, Danny said, yes, that's right, inflation, I mean, is using a different way. Mentioned economists would mean an increase in prices, and Austrians mean an increase in supply of money. There, I think, you know, Austrians would tend to have, they would tend to use inflation in the Austrian sense because that's what they're interested in, Austrian economics, so they use it in that way. But in ethics, I guess they're more influenced by the general, these Essenes who use utilitarianism in a non-Essene way, more influenced by the general concept. Now, another reason, incidentally, why Essenes don't use utilitarianism in Mises' way is that a lot of them aren't familiar really with Mises' philosophy. That's why everybody should take my next course, Mises' epistemology. We'll be going into Mises' philosophy, not primarily the ethics, but maybe we'll say a little bit about that. So everybody should take my course, so then you won't fall into these mistakes. Well, thank you. Yes, I'm. Let me see. Someone asks if we have some time for some more questions. Yes, Peter Geech. Yes, he's very good. He's very good in criticizing. Peter Geech is one of the top philosophers He's still alive. He's well into his 90s. He's still going on. He's also, Geach was one of the top critics. Remember in my first lecture, when I was talking about concepts, I mentioned the view that Joyce defends is we get concepts through abstraction. You know, this is a view you find also in Ayn Rand. And Geach is one of the leading critics of that. His basic criticism is not the time to really go into that in detail. He says, well, we wouldn't be able to abstract a concept from particulars unless we had the concept to begin with. So if you see anything by Peter Geach, you know it's well worth reading. And also, I say the same of Geach's wife, Elizabeth Anscombe, who's one of the great one of the greatest 20th century philosophers. Now, Danny said he thinks Mises' utilitarianism makes more sense in Rothbard's natural right position. Well, that's an interesting view. I mean, I certainly think Mises' utilitarianism is worth considering. I mean, I tend to be more sympathetic to Rothbard, but you're certainly right that if you're talking about utilitarianism, you should certainly consider Mises' version of it. Rothbardian Titian says, I think that's why I said it's a more nuanced view. I see we have some Misesians on ethics here. Interesting. Ned says, how important to our understanding of logic is knowledge of 19 moods? Well, I didn't think it is very important. I thought it's just, if you're interested in that sort of detail, it's one thing to learn. Now, when scholastic logic was studied, this would be one of the things people would learn, and people would be very good at knowing the different moods. And you remember their Latin verses, you can learn the made up Latin words so you remember what all the moods are. But I tended to think that wasn't one of the things I thought we really need to go into in detail. You know, if you're interested in that, it's you can get that from Joyce. So I see we have some sort of a difference of opinion. Now, I tend to be somewhat of a moral intuitionist. I tend to think there are certain moral principles that are self-evident. But one thing I would say, which is certainly true that both non-utilitarians have to bear in mind, when we say there are other things besides consequences that count in ethics, this isn't to say that the consequences don't count at all. It's just the contention would be there are other things as well. So, I mean, you would always have to consider the consequences of what you're doing. Anish says, is there anything you should be careful about in this regard? In which regard? I'm not sure. Now, Eric says, don't utilitarian natural law theories both derive commands from descriptions? Isn't this a fallacy per David Hume? Well, natural law, at least in the most common version, is deriving oughts from is, but they would say it's not a fallacy. Hume would have said that, but they would deny that. And now utilitarianism is not deriving the command from description, because it's saying it's starting off with the principle we ought to maximize happiness and we ought to live on terms of peaceful social cooperation. So it isn't going that way. I mean, you could come up with versions of natural law that are not deriving oughts from is. It's like, so I'm supposed to just add the premise we ought to live in accord with our nature. And if you add that, then you're not deriving ought from an is. Joel says he's not sure why Rothbard provides the critique of Mises. Well, the reason he does that, I think, is, remember, he's defending this kind of natural law ethics. And so one objection you have is, maybe you don't need this. You know, maybe Mises is saying you can show that various kinds of intervention or interference with free market won't work just from the point of view of people who advocate those things. So the reason Rothbard put that in, he wants to say, well, how would he defend himself against the claim that what he's doing is unnecessary? Oh, and he's with reference to material and text. Well, I don't think there's anything you really have to watch out for in the sense of things that you want to disagree with. It's just if you find that he's going into what you consider enormous amounts of detail, you really don't have to learn that. Now, Bill said ought is what would lead to fulfillment. Yeah, I mean, you probably, people sympathetic to natural law would take it that way. I mean, you could object to that. I mean, you could say that's not what ought means. That's just a particular conception of what you ought to do. But that's not what the meaning of the term is. But the natural law, many natural law people would take it just, you know. And guess what? What's your take on Pritchard, H.A. Pritchard? Oh, yeah, Pritchard is one, in my view, one of the greatest of all moral philosophers, H.A. Pritchard. Yes, everybody should read his great essay, Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake? I have an extremely high view of this. Well, Danny, I'll read your thread, but I'm not going to click on it now because that would knock me out of the meeting. We don't want to do that again. That happened to me before. Probably some, well, I'll tell you one story in the Knocktown meeting. The Monday evening, I had an email from Danny saying that Stefan Kinsella's class had started and we could click on the dim to go into that and listen to it. So I thought I'd listen to the lecture, and he's a very interesting lecture. I wanted to hear what he had to say. So I clicked on it. And I didn't realize it because I'm a visiting professor. The effect of my doing that was to knock him out of the lecture. So I had to exit because I was knocking him out of his own lecture. So I have to listen. So I have to wait till the lecture's posted before I can listen to it because I actually knocked him out of his own lecture. Yeah, yes, I'm the guilty party. He'd probably say I'm stopped from going into his lecture again. Okay, now do we have any last few questions? We have a little, oh, he had it coming. Yes, that would be funny, you know, say imagine, say one professor criticizing something somebody else has said, and then you have the other professor knocking out saying, no, I didn't mean that. Andreas wants to know, how do I get into Austro-Libertarianism? Well, actually, you know, when I was in junior high, Man, Economy, and State came out, and I read that right away, so I thought it was very good. I was kind of convinced by it then, but I didn't meet Murray Rothbard until 1979, but I read the book in 1962, so that was how I got interested in that. Now, Yoshi wants to say, Austrians believe value is subjective. They same thing about morality. Well, remember, the Austrian view, Austrian economics is not dealing with morality at all. So it leaves open what your view about ethics is. You know, I mean, it's not Austrian economics is not an ethical theory. Let's see, is there any last questions or comments? Well, I guess I'll see you all, I hope, next week. And thanks very much for coming to, well, someone says, who do I think was nuttier, Mill or Rand? Well, I think I wouldn't say either was nutty, really. Danny said, didn't Keynes send students to other lectures to harangue? Yes, he did that to Dennis Robertson. Yes, that's right. And Joan Robinson used to do that to other people. She'd come into their lectures and ask all sorts of questions. Eric, well, that's an interesting, I don't think you have to get brainwashed. You just have to be a bit tactful about, it's not a good idea if you find a professor who's very opposed to your ideas to keep arguing with them. And Ned's looking forward to next week's show. Well, that's very kind of you, Ned. I'll try to come up with something. Okay, thanks everybody. Thank you. Well, I'm going to stop the recording now. Okay, thanks everybody. Bye.